I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. Unchain your sweet tooth. I'll tell you about some of LA's best desserts today on the show. Natural wine, exactly what that means. Korean pub food, corn smut, plus Jonathan Gold stops by with a restaurant for us to try. But first, as always, let's check in and see what's in season at the Los Angeles area farmers markets.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's always great to find out what to do with summer fruit. One of those great perennial summer fruits is blueberries. And we're visiting today with Brandon Boudet, who is the chef owner of a restaurant called Little Dom and Dominic's. You are a New Orleans native, and you were telling us you make two great dishes with blueberries. Can you share those with us?
Yes. Well, the first one is very simple. Bringing back my heritage of New Orleans, it's the traditional New Orleans snowball. But a little twist on it, we actually use fresh syrups. We take fresh blueberries with a little bit of sugar and some water and just cook it down a little bit into where it gets jammy and then cool it down and then strain it off. And we have this wonderful blueberry syrup, which we pour over finely shaved ice, similar to Hawaiian shaved ice. But in New Orleans, they're known as the snowball.
It's a snow cone.
It's a snow cone. Uh-huh. Yeah, definitely. Uh-huh. And it can also be used. You could take that syrup and you could crush some ice. Pour some of that syrup over the crushed ice and top it with some fresh whipped cream. That would go great. But I think the best thing for blueberries is the ricotta blueberry pancake that we just started serving at brunch at Dominic's. And we also have it at Little Dom's for breakfast and lunch.
And how do you go about doing that?
We have a little bit of flour, some baking soda, all the dry ingredients, some sugar, a little bit of salt. And then we mix in the wet ingredients, which we have some egg yolk. First, we mix in with a little bit of melted butter and milk. Mm-hmm. And we mix those two ingredients together. And then we just slowly fold in some fresh ricotta cheese, fresh, drain it off if it's a little wet. The part that makes it really work is that old cast iron skillet that you have, that you got from your grandmother. You want to take that skillet and get it nice and medium hot or so to start the pancakes off. And you ladle your pancakes onto that skillet with a little bit of butter all around there, get it going. And then once it starts to cook, you start adding your fresh blueberries to the top side of the pancake. Then when it's almost cooked, you flip it over. And then add a little bit more butter to that cast iron skillet and let it go for a little while until those pancakes are done. And then you want to serve it with some real maple syrup and a little bit more butter. It's a great, great breakfast on that Sunday morning when it's a little hazy outside and you don't feel like quite getting up right away.
Okay. Oh, my gosh. That sounds so good. That was Brandon Boudet, and he is the chef owner of Little Dom's, which is in Las Feliz, and then Dominic's, which is in West Hollywood. Now that we're getting some truly hot summer days, we're looking for a refreshing drink to satisfy ourselves and our kids and our friends. And, of course, we want to stay away from something too sweet and too overprocessed. It occurred to me that Cheryl Gaines, who sells herbs at her stand called It Began in the Garden, has a wide selection of herbal teas. And she's also got this wonderful dried herb called stevia. But let's talk first about your herbs and the teas you have.
Well, our herbal teas, our herbal blend, which is a rose hips high vitamin C. It has lemongrass and peppermint in it. Makes a very heavy body tea, a real robust tea, mm-hmm. and makes a wonderful iced tea. But my newest favorite is the lemon lavender tea, because it makes a very cool, light green, refreshing, all-day-long tea. And it can be made either hot or it can be made iced.
Okay.
Now, when I make an iced tea, some people make it as a sun tea, which means that's room temperature water, seal it in the jar, and brew it until it gets to the taste that you want. Or you can do it as a hot tea and brew it 3 to 5 minutes for a mm-hmm. cup of tea, and then ice it. Now, when I ice it, I don't use a regular ice cube. By then, I'm making my ice out of my herbs. So my mint and my basil, they all go in the ice cube. So when I add that to the tea, it flavors it even more.
Right, because the problem with icing hot tea is you put so much ice in that it becomes diluted.
Right.
And then if you want to add more ice, then it's just too watery.
Right.
So, yeah,
you can
do that.
You can also take the brewed tea uh-huh. and make it into ice cubes. So you can make some interesting combinations where you might have a lemon verbena with the chamomile. Chamomile is another very sleepy time tea. We've got spearmint, very refreshing in the summer, and with a sprig of basil in there. What about a little Thai basil?
Mm. So your tea, you've got the dry leaf teas, and you also have the fresh herbs. If I'm making a tea, say, out of your fresh, if I want to cut some herbs and make tea that way.
You use more fresh than you would of the dry. The dried is already concentrated, think about it.
Okay.
And the fresh needs, you need to use a little bit more.
And the stevia itself is a natural herb, all natural. You sell the dried stevia in little dried flakes.
Right.
If I was going to make limeade, and of course when you make lime or lemonade, you have to add a ton of sugar. How would I add stevia to some lime juice to make a nice sweet limeade?
Well, there's actually two ways to do that. You can brew the stevia like you would a normal tea. In other words, boil the water, put the stevia dried leaves in it, steep it for 3 to 5 minutes like you do any other tea, and that water liquid becomes a sweetener. You can add that to your liking, to limeade or whatever else you're using, or you can add it directly. If you add it directly, you might want to run it through a food mill, a coffee mill, because it'll make it really, really fine. Our stevia is not processed, it's not bleached, it's not white, it doesn't have extra things in it, mm-hmm. It's straight stevia. So you're looking the pure thing. We also carry the stevia plants. That's where our dried stevia comes from, is from our plants.
Yeah, what about putting a sprig or two or five of stevia into my pitcher of limeade that I haven't sweetened yet?
Absolutely.
And let that kind of soak up until it gets sweet enough?
It would work.
And then, I guess, remove the stems once I'm done?
Yeah. The stevia is 300 times sweeter than sugar. It's been used as a sweetener for a long time. It's something that you can use not just in drinks, but you can also use it in sauces, or you could, like, if you're, like, making a salad dressing and it's a little too sour for you, mm-hmm. add a little stevia like you would normally sugar, and it'll equalize that flavor. Same thing, spaghetti sauce, same thing. Too acidic, add a little stevia.
So take a pinch out here and
just
there and
a
use
pinch.
It?
Yeah. Just a pinch is all you need.
Speaking of lemonade and summer and great causes, I'm visiting right now with Josh Loeb and Zoe Nathan, who are the owners and the wonderful creative forces behind Rustic Canyon and Huckleberry. And Josh, you were telling me that you're going to get involved with this project called Project Lemonade. I guess it started as a lemonade stand so kids could get their teachers hired back due to these budget cuts. You've signed up at Huckleberry and Rustic Canyon to do a special fundraiser that's going to raise awareness about the teachers and then raise money both through a dinner and through a silent auction.
We're going to do a dinner at Huckleberry, and that actually got filled up pretty quickly with all the parents who want to come and support the cause. But we're also going to do a silent auction. It's going to be a very foodie-driven silent auction. So it's going to be like Zoe's going to do a baking class for 6 people, private baking class. Evan Funky at Rustic Canyon is going to do a farmer's market tour, and then he's going to take everyone back and do a special 4-course tasting menu with wine pairings at the restaurant. Cafe Lux is going to do a special coffee basket with great single-origin coffees. Everyone's kind of getting involved, and we're going to have that online, or actually the Project Lemonade people are going to have it online August 6th through the 13th.
All right, Josh. Well, thank you, Josh and Zoe. Thank you so much for doing that and for helping out the teachers in the school district and helping us learn how to cook better in the process. Thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
I want to remind everybody that our next library panel is going to be held Thursday, August 12th. It's at the Santa Monica Main Library from 7 till 9 p.m. This time, our topic is going to be called Conscientious Carnivore. It's a whole panel on farmers who are sustainably and humanely raising animals for consumption. The panel will be moderated by our very own Evan Kleiman. So please do come out August 12th at the Santa Monica Main Library from 7 to 9, free and open to the public. For The Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Pictures and recipes from The Market Report are at kcrw.com/goodfood. Fair trade, organic, direct, shade grown. These are all terms used to describe coffee. Here to help us make sense of all the categories is Kevin Sinnott. He's the curator for coffeecompanion.com. Let's start with organic.
Well, organic is, of course, we're actually starting with, the most complicated one, because organic sounds so simple and straightforward, but we're really talking about organic certified. And the reason I want to differentiate that is because, for instance, there are a number of coffees, great coffees in the world, that are organic, but they're not certified organic. To be certified organic, you have to meet a certain criteria, and you also have to be able to pay to have someone certify you, and that complicates things quite a bit, because in the coffee business, there are still a lot of what I'd call mom-and-pop coffee growers in the world, and there are entire countries, regions like Ethiopia, for instance, where there's really never, as far as I know, been a petrochemical imported in order to control pests or anything like that, that organic would seem to be concerned with. And at the same time, almost none of the coffee is certified organic because none of these people can afford to be certified.
Are there any other countries in which organic is just sort of the way, like the traditional way?
What you really want to do is in mountainous countries is grow coffee higher than the bugs like to fly. I mean, that sounds really simple, but that's about it. And then from there on, the micro farms really don't have a problem with this. I mean, it's only in the industrialized coffee culture that you really find that's a significant issue. So in other words, if you're buying canned coffees, I think looking for the term organic is laudable because in countries where there's a really industrialized coffee, like Brazil, I think it's worth thinking of searching out organics. But when you're talking about Ethiopia or Rwanda, Peru, countries like that, most of the coffees, by and large, are probably organic just because, frankly, the families are too broke to be able to afford to get any kind of pest control.
Okay, now let's move to shade-grown coffee. Isn't all coffee grown under a canopy?
Well, no. And shade-grown turned into a really nice, it's a nice idea. It's wonderful. The idea is what you're doing is you want a summer home for the birds, or actually it's a winter home for us, for the birds that we love to see, the songbirds outside in our yards and in the neighborhoods. Like a lot of us, they fly, like I want to, they fly south in the winter. And what they do is they traditionally like to nest in trees that are used to shade coffee trees. So the concept was, let's promote this idea. But here's the catch. First of all, there's a lot of coffees that are grown that can't be called shade grown because, frankly, they're not. They either are in climates where there's a cloud cover a good deal of time, and it's really unnecessary to grow a second tree. It's not always necessary to have a second tree to shade the coffee trees. Similarly, again, mountain-grown coffees that are truly mountain-grown, typically, if the farm is situated right, the mountain itself shades the coffee enough time during the day. So neither one are in direct sunlight. What we're really talking about is the differentiation between rows and rows of planted coffee plantations where they are, in order to save real estate, have not grown the second tree. And there it would be a benefit to have shade-grown coffee and have a second tree. I'm a little concerned because, for instance, you want to be careful not to force the farmers to grow shade trees at the expense of other trees that might be more important to grow. For instance, in Guatemala a couple of years ago, there was a mudslide and an entire town was washed away. And it turns out they would have been better off planting cypress trees, which don't provide much shade for coffee trees, but they would be better because they tend to glue the ground together and would help prevent mudslides. That would be actually a better idea. We're a powerful consuming block. I want to be careful that we don't try to encourage farmers to do the wrong things in order to label packages for me so that I feel better, but they really don't provide the long-term benefit.
Let's move to fair trade coffee. What exactly is it, and how does it relate also to direct coffee? Because now you start to see a differentiation between these two.
Yeah, there's a real differentiation. And fair trade is, look at it this way, fair trade is like kind of a unionization of sorts. It's a third party that collects the money for you, and they take a piece of that money generally, and you end up making a few cents more per hour. Now, I don't want to belittle that. A few cents more per hour in some of the regions that grow coffee is a significant raise, but it's not as significant as direct trade. And I'll give you another example. I was at a farm where they are direct trade. And in fact, direct trade is different because direct trade eliminates the fair trade middleman or middle person. And direct trade, we were told the farmers there make 2.5 times what they would make if they were fair trade. The difference is quite significant. Direct trade is ideal. Now, on our end, where we are as buyers, the challenge for direct trade is to find, I love the mom and pop roasters, coffee roasters out there, the people that, and for them, buying direct trade coffee is difficult because, frankly, they're not probably big enough that they're making these junkets to the emerging countries that grow coffee and cutting these deals. And really, you know, they're, for them, fair trade is going to be a step up. And certainly for a commodity coffee, meaning the coffee that's sold in cans in grocery stores, fair trade is an improvement because at least there's some third-party certification of it, meaning certified that there's a better deal for the workers, the people who actually pick and grow and farm the coffee. That's a better deal. But I think that direct trade is what we're all working for. We see fair trade or direct trade. I'd say direct trade is generally speaking, going to be better for the farmers.
Kevin Sinnott's book is The Art and Craft of Coffee. I'll have more of my conversation with Kevin next week on Good Food. We'll talk about how you can roast your own coffee beans at home. Up next, Korean pub grub, what that is and why it will make your mouth water. I'll be back in 30 seconds. This is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Say Korean food, and most of the non-Korean community of eaters thinks of barbecue. Chef Debbie Lee of the Next Food Network star fame wants to change all that, so she's rolling out in the Anju food truck. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, how are you?
What does Anju mean?
Anju means a snack that you ask for at a Korean pub or a drinking house. It's basically when you go into a drinking house, you get your beer or your liqueur, and then you ask them Anju Iseo, which means, is there food here? It could be anything from some nuts to some fruit to obviously my personal favorites like Korean fried chicken and all those goodies.
Where does the tradition of Anju sit in sort of the Korean culinary universe?
Actually, you know, the idea of a Korean pub is a daily stop for us Koreans in our normal lifestyle. It's the place that we go to after work, on our way home, on our way to meet friends for a drink before dinner and get a little snack. It's our place that, you know, us girls like to go afterwards and commiserate about our bad date on a Friday night. So,
so this idea of Korean fried chicken, it's sort of taken LA's more adventurous eaters by storm. People are obsessed with it.
Correct. They are. I love that LA is loving the fried chicken all around, whether it's, you know, regular all-American or Korean-style fried chicken. I'm loving it.
So is it a traditional thing or is it something that's like a hybrid?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think now that, you know, the big chains like the BBQ Chicken and the Kyochans and Bonchan and those guys, they've definitely, I think, evolved into what's more of a westernized style of a Korean fried chicken. Traditionally, what it is, it's called tonggak, which means a whole chicken. Think of taking your chicken, cutting it in half, and basically sort of pounding it a little bit, skin on, deep frying it twice. And you eat it normally with a little bit of tongchimi, which is a winter pickled daikon. And you basically eat it with like maybe a little hot sauce, some pancakes, and you roll it up with a little sea salt and sesame oil. And that's how my grandma used to serve it to us. I remember when I first had it, and mind you, I was raised on Southern fried chicken. I go, Mom, I'm not eating that. Are you out of your mind? Nowadays, I think a lot of the Korean chains that are out in America, especially, they do the flouring kind of process. But if we go back to the roots of our grandmothers, no, grandma didn't dip it in any flour. She just sort of fried that puppy and gave it to you straight on a plate.
So it like had sort of a chicken chicharrone quality.
Exactly. That's the best way to describe it. Yeah, because when you twice fry it, it really builds that crispiness of the skin. And that's really the beautiful part. Like my favorite part of Thanksgiving, for example, is that skin after it's been roasting and crackling.
So truck. You decided after doing the Next Food Network star to do a truck.
You know, it's funny. I had been going back and forth on the truck because everybody kept saying, you should do a truck, you should do a truck. And of course, you know, my main focus has been getting my brick and mortar open, which should be opening right before the holidays this year. But, you know, it's funny. I was contacted by the LA Film Festival and their old catering clients of mine. And they said, would you want to do a truck concept there? And, you know, my partner I talked about, and we're like, well, it's sort of senseless for us to just do it part time. We might as well just go for it and blast it out and let people get all the K grub they can get. So, you know, sort of not planned. But, you know, the truck community has been incredible.
Take me through your menu.
So my menu is a mini version of my favorite items that I like to get at a Korean pub. There's a couple places that I will go after work, when especially when I'm working in a restaurant. And the drinking house is perfect because they're open and they serve food till 2 a.m. And not many places do that in L.A.
So in L.A., what are a couple of your favorite brick and mortar places?
I like going to Dong Sung Sa on 6th Street. And I also like The Prince. The Prince actually has one of the best versions to me of Korean fried chicken, how it's really supposed to be served. Gom over at the Chapman Square is really good. So, you know, it's that's definitely the place to go with your friends and have a good time. So,
okay, so let's talk about some of your favorites.
Yes. What started out as a joke has turned into my second most popular item, and it's what I call the Korean nachos. It's my variation and mockery of tteokbokki, which in a Korean pub, it's basically little rice cakes. Think of sort of like a rice gnocchi per se. And we toss it normally in either a soy sauce or a spicy chili bean sauce with the gochujang, fish cakes, you know, the drill. I decided nowadays what they do is they take a piece of like American cheese and put it under the salamander. And so you're getting that chili with the cheese. And to me, it just didn't work. It wasn't, you know, I love my Korean peeps and I love my drinking house. It wasn't the flavors I was looking for. So as a joke, one of the servers said, well, wait, maybe you should make some kind of a nacho. Ha ha ha. So, of course, me with my mac and cheese sauce, I variated that and used some Korean chili powder, did a soy braised pulled pork, decided to deep fry those rice cakes so they're crispy on the outside. And then I added some Korean charred peppers and a kimchi salsa, and everybody goes crazy over it.
What else? Give us more.
I sell probably about, to give you an idea, about 2,000 Korean dumplings a week. It's called mandu.
And how does it differ from dumplings from other Asian countries?
Well, you know, Korean dumplings actually have different variations. My ancestry is originally from Northern Korea. So pre-war, we were all from Pyongyang at that time. And the Northern style dumplings very meaty. So all what you get is ground pork, for example, like maybe 10% is fillers with the kimchi or whatever you add it. I decided to take that up a notch, and I do a pork rillette in-house that I make that I season with ginger and garlic and all the good stuff, and I integrate that into my mandu filling. So it's creamy, and it's even more decadent than it should be.
It's been great talking with you, Debbie. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Debbie Lees on Jew Truck will be at the West Side Food Fest today from noon to 4 p.m. at Venice High School. She'll be joined by India Jones, Fish Lips Sushi, Maui Wowie, The Sweets Truck, and many more. Details are on the Good Food Events calendar at kcrw.com/goodfood. One of the wonderful things about the food truck craze is that it's bringing previously unknown ethnic dishes to diners all over the city. Take wheat lacoche, for example. It's a popular ingredient for many Mexican street food vendors, and it literally translates to corn fungus or corn smut. Steve Sando of Rancho Gordo joins me now to explain what exactly that means.
In English, we say corn smut. And it's a reason for burning a whole field, among many farmers' opinions. But in Mexico, it's when one of the kernels of the corn gets infected with a fungus, and it just swells and grows and turns dark and turns into actually something really delicious.
Could you describe what it looks like when it's still sort of hanging on the infected corn?
You know, you want to encourage people to do this, but the reality is it looks like some sort of tumor that's just out of control. And it's dark and black, and it looks like a brain that has had far too much Xbox play. That's what it looks like. It's,
yeah, it's very,
really vile.
It's very brainy looking in a really strange way. And once you cook it, does it change color?
No, it kind of gets darker and grayer, I suppose. I mean, no, not really.
Now, what about the flavor? I've heard some people liken it to a kind of truffle flavor.
Yes. Now, I have to say, I think it's very good, and I love using things that normally would cause a field to be burned. Instead, we're saving it and even getting a higher value for it. But the reality is there's some people who go a little too off on it, like it's a truffle. And it's I love truffles, and it's not a truffle. It's a very wonderful mushroom-type, earthy, delicious thing. But I don't want to go too far into the it's ambrosiatic, truffle, fabulous sort of thing. You do hear people go off, and it's like, oh, come on, it's not that good. And that's right. That's the camp I'm in. It's very good, and it's great we're eating it, but it's not the it's not a truffle, believe me.
And what about from a nutritional standpoint?
Well, that's the wild thing is apparently no one has done any nutritional studies up until very recently because people are trying to export it from Mexico. And, you know, with my company, we our whole promotions is New World Food and helping us to understand food that's indigenous to the Americas and maybe being slightly better neighbors. I've avoided health as a topic, but apparently the Huitlacoche, you can't, it's smacking you in the face. It's full of all these really good things that you don't get in regular corn.
Which is fascinating, the fact that it lives on corn and yet it manages just to transmute whatever is in the corn into things that are much, much better for us.
It's pretty funny. And especially when you consider, again, I don't mean to keep going back to this, that here in this country, we burn the fields when we find it. So it's like this is a miracle health food, and we're going to get rid of it.
So I want to ask you more about that, the burning of the fields. Is this the primary sort of pest that very large corn farmers fight?
Well, speaking to someone in California, it's not for us the best crop to grow because it's water intensive. It takes a lot of nutrients, whereas, you know, where we grow beans, they actually improve the soil by fixing the nitrogen, and the pods go back in as green manure. So as a crop, it's not something I think is really that sustainable in most places in California unless you've got incredible irrigation things. It's not a huge problem, but it is a problem. And it means when someone does have it, the good thing is it means that they're probably organic or they're not praying, doing fungicides. So that is really a good reason to go to that farmer. But the problem is that farmer often will think, I got to start using fungicides. And I had this once when I worked at the farmer's markets. So I got started. There was a farmer next to me who was showing up, and he just was heartbroken. I said, no, let me help you. We're going to sell this. So every time a Mexican would come by, I'd say, look what we've got. And they'd go crazy. And I'd sell the corn for twice the price. But he said it won't happen next year, meaning he was going to start using the heavy guns, which is just heartbreaking.
And yet, I understand that you actually are working on seeing if you can inoculate it on purpose into
and
corn.
And encourage it, yeah. And home gardeners can do this, too, if you want. Once the corn is growing, you put a slit at the base and water it heavily. And if it's there, apparently it's a great way to make it spread. So you can try it at home, too. But yeah, apparently, though, it's turning out some people are allergic to it. But I think some people are allergic to everything. So I don't know how serious it is. I would approach it with caution. We're starting to grow heirloom corn. We're growing it here. We've been growing it for a while, and we're also importing it now from Mexico just to, in a nice way, create a market so that people don't have to grow GMOs or hybrids. But one of the things is we're going to start making heirloom corn tortillas. And because of that, we've got a couple of extra fields. And I thought, well, let's just try creating some Huitlacoche. So we're in the process of it right now. And I think we're going to do pretty well.
So encouraging Huitlacoche is sort of like an added value product for a corn farmer.
Exactly. But, you know, again, unfortunately, and this is what we find with the farmers markets, the skill set to bring a fabulous crop of Huitlacoche to market isn't the same skill set as marketing it. So it's really hard on the farmers. And the same thing with beans or whatever crop it is. It's just they're two different skill sets. So hopefully we've got a strong farmers market manager who knows how to appeal to the very rich or recent immigrants or, you know, adventurous foodies. But it's the same way in Mexico, actually, because there it's really the very poor and the very rich who are eating it. It's not a middle class treat.
That's so interesting.
The poor eat it because it's what it produces and they love it and it's fabulous. They make tortillas. But then the high-end places in Mexico City, you see it really at high-end restaurants where you'll see it often in a crepe tied with a chive string and in a cream sauce, which I think is just kind of gross. It's too rich. But I did have it once on a beautiful egg pasta and someone had made a sauce of it.
Wow.
And it was very nice. But it was a real high-end restaurant in Mexico City.
What varieties of heirloom corn are you growing?
Well, we have this wonderful program where we're working with small indigenous farmers who haven't been treated very well by NAFTA. And so they were working in the Huasteca region, Oaxaca, and Puebla. And so there's red corns, yellow corns, blue corns. And by growing this corn, we're encouraging them to continue growing the types they've grown for thousands of years rather than taking these hybrids. So instead of saying don't grow hybrids or don't grow GMOs, we're saying, you know, actually there's a market for your heirloom varieties and we can actually pay you more. So it's actually a better idea not to grow these. So it's a kind of a win-win for everybody. And for us, we get this fabulous corn that we wouldn't have access to. And for them, they get to continue doing what they're doing rather than, you know, growing a hybrid or working at a Ford plant.
So do you have a favorite way that you prepare wheat lacoche when you have an opportunity to have it in your own home kitchen?
Yes, because I'm poor, so somewhat poor because I'm in food business. So what I like to do is usually I saute an onion and garlic in a little lard, but I use freshly rendered lard, not that icky white stuff from the grocery store. And if you most Mexican markets, you can buy tubs of lard for very inexpensive amounts, and it's usually the carnita strippings, and they're incredible. But anyway, so just a spoonful or so, onion and garlic, and a serrano chili, and then I add the wheat lacoche. And stir it around. You can find it canned occasionally, and it's not the devil. I mean, it's not that bad. It's not the same, but it's not great. And then once that's soft, I take tortillas and make quesadillas with it, and with maybe a little queso fresco, and call it a day. And it just, you want to do it simply because it's pretty subtle, but it's also pretty wonderful. And I think the combination of the corn and the wheat lacoche is pretty great.
Steve Sando runs Rancho Gordo, a food company specializing in ingredients native to the Americas. Up next, I want to indulge your sweet tooth. Put away your calorie counter for the next few minutes. Let's go for it. The best desserts in L.A. next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back in 1 minute here on KCRW and KCRW.com. When dining out, appetizers pique interest and appetite at the start of a meal. Your hunger sated and your intellect might be intrigued by a marvelous entree, but it's that sweet punctuation at the end which sends you out into the night air on a cloud. Antoinette Bruno, CEO and editor-in-chief of StarChefs.com, is here to share some thoughts on a few noteworthy pastry chefs here in L.A. So talk to us a little bit about what we have here.
Great. Let's start with one end of the spectrum, which would be Jordan Kahn, who's probably one of my favorite pastry chefs in the entire country. And for the last 2 years, he's been at Michael Mina 14, and he's actually leaving to start his own restaurant, which is going to open in the middle of August. But I would love to talk about his pastry. One of the ones he served me was called Strawberries, Strawberries. And it was this incredible dessert that was lots of different types of strawberries with an elderflower meringue. It had white chocolate spheres that were filled with a strawberry puree. It had a cacao fruit sorbet. It had violet sauce. It had a beet genoise. The textures were just incredible, but it was beautiful. He's sort of part mad scientist, part artist, but he's one of the most creative pastry chefs, young pastry chefs in this country.
So who would be next on your list?
Moving from mad scientist to experimental, maybe introducing some unusual ingredients. And in that regard, I would put two pastry chefs who have kind of similar styles, but are in two very different restaurants. One is Adrian Vasquez, who's at Providence. And the other is Kai Hazekiah Gawa, who's at Sashi, which is a Japanese restaurant that's over on the beach. Now, Adrian Vasquez won our 2010 Los Angeles Rising Star Award, and we've actually known Adrian for quite some time. We first were introduced to Adrian, I guess, maybe 5 or 6 years ago when he was working at Bin 36 in Chicago. And one of the desserts he served me way back then, which gave me sort of a window into who Adrian was going to become as a pastry chef, he served me this cucumber push-up pop. So you remember as a kid and you got those push-up pops from the Good Humor truck, you know, and you pushed up the stick and the pop popped through?
Those were fun.
They were fun. Well, this was made with cucumbers.
Unbelievable.
So again, thinking outside the box, taking a familiar dessert, the push-up pop, but then taking a flavor, cucumber, that you wouldn't normally associate with pastry and putting it in this very cold but very refreshing push-up pop. And that was one of the very first pastries that he served me when I first met him. Now, today, he's grown. He's matured. He's in a very sophisticated restaurant, Providence. And the dish that sort of wowed me or won my heart was a calamansi gelée with a lychee shiso sorbet. So, you know, shiso is that Japanese green leaf that's it has a wonderful texture and a wonderful sort of minty flavor. And he made a sorbet with lychees and shiso. And then it had a white chocolate coconut soup. And the coconut soup had tapioca pearls inside. And then it had a chocolate nougatine. So it had the wonderful texture of the gelée, the cold sorbet. It had the soup. It had the tapioca pearls, which have this wonderful mouth feeling. And then it had the crunchy chocolate nougatine. So it had all these different textures working, all these levels of flavors. And a typical pastry chef might not be able to pull that off, but it was spectacular, not only in its visual appeal, but in its flavor components. It was a fantastic pastry.
Wow.
So at the same time I would describe Adrian, I would compare and contrast him with another pastry chef, which I mentioned, Kai Hasegawa, who's at Sashi, who's a Japanese pastry chef. So you get sort of some of that Asian influences that you saw with Adrian. And here is an entirely Japanese pastry chef who's now been influenced by America. And I guess what most wowed me from Kai was a green tea macaroon. And this was probably the single best macaroon I think I've ever had in the United States. It was
wow.
Really, really, really delicious.
And we have it out here.
Yes, and you have it right there in L.A. It's worth a plane ride just to fly to Sashi and have Kai's macaroons. They are that good.
So now do we turn our attention to the more familiar and nostalgic?
Definitely. The next couple of pastry chefs that I'd like to talk about is Dalia Narvez, and I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. She's at Mozza and Pizzeria Mozza. Dalia does the sort of the very comfort foodie but Italian pastry. So there were a couple dishes that really wowed me. One was her butterscotch budino that had Maldon sea salt and rosemary pine nut cookies. So the butterscotch budino is like a little pudding that's in a cup. And then it has this, you know, luscious, creamy, tangy flavor. It had cream fraiche on the top, and it had Maldon sea salt. And then so you bit into this creamy pudding, and then you bit this wonderful savory rosemary cookie. So it had this crunch. It had this herbal counterpoint. It was really absolutely divine. So now the other end of the spectrum.
Which seems to be so much in our present, sort of the past.
It totally is. And, you know, maybe it's part of the economy. Everybody sort of reverts back to things that make them feel good. And a lot of that has to do with childhood. So there are two pastry chefs that I think do a really superb job of reminding us about our childhood and nostalgia. I grew up in the 60s and the 70s. So things that immediately come to my mind are Ding Dongs, Ho Ho's, Ring Dings. And the person who's the queen of the nostalgia desserts in L.A. is Elizabeth Belkind with Cake Monkey.
Who do we end this really delicious buffet with?
The person to end with is Zoe Nathan at Huckleberry. I'll never forget the first time I walked into Huckleberry's, and I went there for a tasting, and I started with all these wonderful egg dishes, and then the progression just kept going to all these different baked goods, and finally it came to a banana cream pie, and I just thought I lost it. that is the creamiest, the most luscious, the most intense banana-flavored cream pie. It is just wonderful. And then you top it off with her chocolate pudding pie. I mean, it just... Talk about cravings. That's just, I mean, it's comfort food. You know, it's the pie your grandmother made. And it just looks as good as it tastes.
Zoe Nathan is one of our judges in the second annual Good Food Pie Contest, Labor Day weekend in Beverly Hills. It's an opportunity for bakers of all stripes to cook for some of the best mouths in L.A. Other judges include Jonathan Gold, Akasha Richmond of Akasha, Sang Unifather's Office, Karen Hatfield of Hatfield's, and more. For details and to enter your pie, go to kcrw.com/pie. For a list of the pastry chefs Antoinette just talked about, go to kcrw.com/goodfood. I'd love to hear about a great dessert that you've had recently. Go to today's show to leave a comment. Antoinette Bruno is the CEO of StarChefs.com. They're holding their first ever international pastry chef competition in September in New York City. Okay, so as amazing as those desserts sound, eating them often is pretty unrealistic. I want to introduce you to Tom Kaplan. He's the owner of Hugo's in West Hollywood and Studio City. The restaurant's been open for 30 years. It started as a butcher shop and then became a restaurant serving lots of veal and pasta dishes. But now they're known for some alternative dishes that are gluten-free and vegan. I asked Tom why they made the change.
My wife and I are both yoga teachers since 1990, and we brought in a lot of yogic cooking. Our chef was from Mexico, is from Mexico, and we brought in a lot of his ideas. Our staff, we have a beautiful staff, and a lot of them had interests, like they were vegan and raw, and we wanted to make our staff happy, and we were getting a lot of comments from our customers, and so we took it on as a challenge. How can we stick with making really delicious food and come up with exciting vegetarian and vegan and gluten-free and diabetic-friendly dishes?
And I understand that you've developed a dessert that's a treat, but a different kind of treat called frosato.
We have that at our taco stand in Atwater Village. When we opened the taco stand, we really wanted to have some kind of soft serve for the summertime. And I went to soft serve trade shows and everything was, you know.
Buy this bag of powdered ingredients and dump it in, right?
Right. Or something frozen that had been sitting in a warehouse for a long time. And in our restaurants, our chef had been working with Japanese white sweet potatoes making cheesecakes, vegan cheesecakes. So he said, let me come up with something. And our chef, Nabor, is just, he's just brilliant. He is always coming up with things, a lot of them inspired by his mother back in Mexico and the things that he saw his grandparents doing. So he made a frozen white sweet potato with agave, a little bit of agave, and cashew cheese that we make from scratch. And now we have delicious vegan soft serve ice cream.
So the ingredients go through a traditional soft serve machine?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. And what's the texture like?
Like ice cream. I've served it to people and not told them what it was, and they just said it was great ice cream. You really can't tell. I mean, it's maybe a little bit more crystally, you know, a little bit more icy, but for the most part, it tastes like really good in-between ice cream and soft-serve yogurt.
Hugo's Frosato is available at their taco stand on Glendale Boulevard in Atwater Village. Tom Kaplan contributed a vegan pumpkin pie to our Pie a Day project on the Good Food blog. Check it out, along with many other really fabulous pies, at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up next, we'll explore the world of natural wine. Plus, Jonathan Gold's here with a restaurant for us to try. Stay tuned. This is Good Food. The art and science of winemaking can be as complex or as simple as the winemaker wants to make it. After decades of a very technological influence in many wineries, now some are deciding to go a more simple route. Jared Brandt and his wife Tracy are the duo behind A Donkey and Goat Winery, a natural winery in Berkeley, California. The ethos of the winery is to make wine as au naturel as possible. Jared, I understand that you actually worked in the technology industry up there in Northern California. How did you come to start making wine, and why natural wine?
It's a little bit of a long story, but in 2001, the company I worked for had gone public and then gone private again, and my job became laying people off.
Oh, how lovely.
And yeah, it was wonderful. I laid off a person in New York City, and I worked part of the most of the time in California, and usually a week, a month in New York City. And he was a good friend, and my stomach was in a knot. And that night, I went to a wine bar called The Rhone Wine Bar, which is no longer there. And I used to go there a lot when I was in New York City. And I talked to the Somm, who I've never actually figured out his name. I've tried to track him down. And told him about how miserable my day was and miserable my life was. And he's like, you should try this wine. It's a wonderful wine, and it'll reset your mood. And while I was sitting there drinking the wine, I had a, you know, one of those moments where I questioned my whole life to date. And I decided that I wanted to work for a winery and learn something totally different. And I also decided that that wine was one of the best wines I'd ever have. And it ended up, by happenstance, that's the winery I went to work for. So I ended up quitting my job, contacting the winery, convincing a gentleman named Eric Texier that my girlfriend, now my wife, and I would make great interns. And then we moved to France.
Can you explain what you mean by natural wine?
Natural wine is very hard to define. I think the key for us is there's a couple key definitions. But one is that wine with the least amount of manipulation possible. And grape growing in and of itself is a somewhat manipulative process. Like we plant the vines in America. You know, they're often grafted vines. So I don't think it can be totally free of manipulation. But what I mean very specifically is we do not inoculate our wine with yeast. Many wineries use commercial yeast, which you buy in powder form. We do not add enzymes to enhance the flavors or enhance the color. And we attempt to do as little as possible to make great wine as our first desire, but also to let the terroir shine through.
So given that you do very little manipulation, you are completely dependent on terroir. Could you describe your view of what that is? And do you feel that you have less control because of that?
You asked one of the $64,000 questions in winemaking because of the less control. For us, terroir is a combination of the land, the soil, the climate, or really the very, very microclimate of that particular vineyard, as well as the vines themselves. The grape grower or vineyard manager has a great influence on the terroir. I don't think you can take that out of the play. I mean, there's ways you can try to take that out of the play, but you can't totally. In terms of do we lose control? It's something that we always have done, so I don't think we lose any control. A lot of commercial yeast sellers argue that if you do natural fermentation where you don't add anything, you don't have any control over the fermentation. You don't know what's going to happen. And the interesting thing is if you, having a technology and science background, I always ask, well, show me the evidence. And there is really no evidence. There is no statistical evidence that I've ever seen. And I've even had a PhD scientist at a yeast manufacturer that I know say, oh, the marketing department made it up. We don't know that for a fact. So I don't think we lose control in the sense that we never – no winemaker has true control. I think that we are – and it's kind of like maybe the best example to explain it would be with kids. I have a 5-year-old daughter, and I feel like my role in life is not to totally control her but to guide her direction and to guide her growth and hope that she will end up at a place that will make me proud. And at this stage, I'm sure she will. But I don't. At the same time, I don't ever have total control. She can make choices that are beyond my capability to influence, and that's just something I have to live with.
And in terms of wine, that means that sometimes you're going to get a result that must surprise you, right?
I mean, sometimes things happen that you don't intend to happen, and the results are wonderful, and sometimes the results are negative. in an experiment, we decided to let some rosé oxidize, which is contradictory to standard winemaking. Most winemakers, and what I was taught, is to keep wine away from oxygen. And I decided to experiment with just doing something totally opposite. There is a tradition of doing that in the Jura in France. So I decided to experiment with it. And the first time we did it, we ended up with something totally wonderful. It's hard to describe. I called it – our rosé is named after my daughter, so it's Isabelle's rosé, and I called it Isabelle's crazy rosé. And it tasted somewhere between something like if you added nuts to rosé in a wonderful way. The second year we made it, it turned out exactly the opposite. We ended up dumping it down the drain. I can't tell you exactly what the difference of the 2 years were. I still ponder what I did differently or if I did anything differently. And it was just the natural yeast were different in the winery or the grape skins that year. The beauty of it is I'm not looking for total control. I'm looking for what nature provides and for me to enjoy what it provides.
Jared Brandt and his wife run a donkey and a goat winery in Berkeley. Find out where you can try their wines here in L.A. at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'm joined now by Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the L.A. Weekly. He joins us here on Good Food every week with a restaurant recommendation. So, Jonathan, where are we going today?
We're going to the wilds of Culver City.
Ooh, the hotbed of culinary interest.
Yes. The restaurant we're going to today, Waterloo and City, named after the Tube Line in London, is actually a few miles west of what you think of as the Culver City restaurant scene in what used to be the Crest Coffee Shop.
So if it's named after a tube stop in London, is it English food?
It's kind of English food, but it's kind of not English food. It's a, I guess they call them gastropubs, and I can never figure out what a gastropub is, and I guess if you can't figure out what a restaurant is, then that's probably what it is. I have been to meals there where somebody has been there to guide my beer selection with just exquisite detail, which means that it's probably a gastropub because nobody else really cares about the differences between like Northern California IPAs and San Diego IPAs.
Okay, so what really struck your fancy here?
It's run by Brendan Collins, who's worked in basically brasseries here. He was with Joachim Splechal for a while. He worked at Anisette, and he had a place called Pally House, I think, in a hotel in West Hollywood that was very, very brasserie. And this is a gastropub with definitely sort of a brasserie pedigree. So the most interesting things on the menu, I think actually by far, are the cured meats and terrines, of which there are many.
I noticed that he has Benton's Country Ham on the menu.
Benton's Country Ham is one of just the great products in America.
And what do they do with it here? Do they serve it prosciutto style, just really thinly sliced?
It is. One could possibly wish that it was more thinly sliced, but it's definitely thinly sliced. And it's served with a burrata, like wedges of grilled peaches and corn kernels. They wouldn't seem to have anything to do with each other other than sort of like vaguely midsummer, but they do. And the sweetness of the corn and sort of like the smoky sweetness of the peaches goes extraordinarily well with the delicate yet punch in the stomach smokiness of the ham.
Wow.
It's a good appetizer.
That sounds really, really delicious. What else did you like in terms of the cured or potted selections?
If you pay $32, you can get what's known as the King Chef Selection, which is an enormous board with all of the pâtés and terrines that they have, which is, you know, 8 or 9. And some of the good ones are they do a terrine of smoked salmon. They do a very nice sort of mousse with foie gras whipped with chicken liver, which sort of takes the chicken liver mousse that everybody in town has been doing and just ups at that one little level. It's very nice. There's sort of a very dark and gelatinous and ominous but yet delicious terrine of pig's feet with sweetbreads with a little green sauce, an herb sauce to set off the sort of extreme richness of it. And just a delicious terrine of rabbits and pistachios. there's that character of a meat that, that rabbit has that no other meat has. It's sort of a sweetness, and yet I guess you compare it a tiny bit to pork that you just don't get in most of the taste like chicken category. And it comes out really nicely in this terrine.
What about venturing beyond the sort of the cured meats and the charcuterie? What about some of the entrees? Or
they make decent pastas, which you would not think that a brasserie chef or a gastropub chef would be able to pull off. The one I liked best was probably a hand rolled pasta, kind of a garganelli with oxtail and asparagus, and the pasta was nice. It had the right bite to it, and the oxtail ragu had a deep flavor. Some of the pastas are a little bit duff, like a really stodgy lobster ravioli, which I've gotten every time I've been to the restaurant anyway, because it comes with giant slabs of fried pork belly on top. I mean, we all have our weak points, and I know where mine is. They have pizzas, which I don't think they've quite figured out yet. You know, there's one with beef and Stilton and malt vinegar on sort of a limp crust. It's a bad day at the pub. And I will admit that I haven't had their Merg Makani pizza, and someday I will, like, gird up my courage and plunge more deeply into the pizza repertoire. But some of the main courses are good. They tend towards the big, hearty Sunday roast kind of things. And in fact, they have Sunday roasts on Sunday afternoons. But, you know, if you want long-stewed beef shin with a potato gratin or roast chicken with French fries, you're in good hands.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Glad to be here.
We've been talking about Waterloo and City on Washington Boulevard in Culver City. Get a text message with the exact address, and you can receive a text message each week with the new restaurant info. All you have to do is text GOOD FOOD to 69866. That's GOOD FOOD to 69866. All of Jonathan's restaurant recommendations are on the Good Food restaurant map. It's on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you've already been to Waterloo and City or any of Jonathan's other suggestions, we'd really love to hear what you thought. Leave a comment on today's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can download past episodes and subscribe to the podcast at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can download the podcast there, too. The podcast is a weekly bonus podcast all about pie. And I hope you'll enter a pie in the second annual Good Food Pie Contest. It's Labor Day weekend in Beverly Hills. You can find details at kcrw.com/pie. Good Food is produced and edited by Harriet Ells, with Bob Carlson, Jillian Ferguson, Connie Alvarez, and Laurel Garcia. Jennifer Farrow is our consulting producer. Thanks so much to Gary Masiha, Ronnie Mickelson, and Becky Nelson. I'm Evan Kleinman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.